Welcome to the New Zealand Motoring Podcast, brought to you by podcasts.co.nz.
Welcome to episode 3 of the New Zealand Motoring Podcast. I'm Damien O'Carroll.
And I'm David Linklater, and it's great to be back.
It certainly is. I hope you had a nice Christmas break there, David, and to all our listeners as well.
I did indeed. I know Christmas break's over now, though, because it's time to check in our Christmas cars, which is sort of a first world problem for motoring journalists. Yeah. But we'll talk a bit about those later. Shall we get right into it with a little bit of news?
Absolutely.
There's plenty happening already in the world of cars, even though it's just the start of January. The world's worst kept secret, Lexus GSF. So this is the sort of high performance version of the GS sedan. It's sort of a sister, if you like, to the RCF coupe that we talked about last podcast, I think. And it sort of shows that Lexus is really embracing this high-performance F division, which is sort of their equivalent of BMW M or Mercedes AMG. Mm. GS, quite sort of similar to the RCF in many respects. Same engine, same V8 engine that runs in two cycles for really good economy or heaps of power. It's a little bit larger, and I think it's going to be a little bit less powerful just to make sure that the RCF is sort of the top of the tree when it comes to performance. Yeah,
it'll be an interesting car because I quite like the GS. It's quite a pleasant car to drive.
It is.
As it is. The more powerful versions. Okay, on with the news. Appeared just recently that Nigel Mansell has opened a car dealership in his home of Jersey in the Channel Islands. Now, when you think of an ex-Formula One world champion opening a car dealership, you think top-end sports cars or something. But no, it seems Nigel has gone for Mitsubishis, which is interesting. But given that the Jersey has a population of 100,000 people, you're not going to be selling many Ferraris a year.
It's probably 100,000 quite old people.
I would imagine so. So you would suspect that Mitsubishi is probably quite a good choice. Plus, it will also give some lucky person the chance to say the phrase, "My mother-in-law bought a Mirage off Nigel Mansell," which is something no one ever thought they would say.
We'd probably be a bit remiss at this stage of the year if we didn't just briefly mention the new car sales stats, which sounds awfully dull, doesn't it? But they've come out for last year.
Well, we're just coming off a story from Nigel Mansell selling Mitsubishis, so you're not going to get...
The only way is up. The total number of cars sold in New Zealand, that's new cars, for 2014 was 127,179, which is a record... for 30 years, I think the previous high was in 1984, and it was something like 123,000. So the new car industry is booming. Top selling car, Toyota Corolla, no surprise there.
Big surprise.
The big story around new car sales was really the battle between the Toyota Hilux and the Ford Ranger in the ute segment. Of course, that's all done and dusted now. Ranger trounced Hilux. About 6,300 sales, I think, for Ranger, compared with 5,800 for Hilux.
But as Toyota are very fond of pointing out at the moment, not in the four-wheel drive ute segment.
No, I did love that ad, but I also think that we should respectfully ask, Ford, please stop gloating, and Toyota, please stop pretending that you didn't lose. It's been done to death. Let's just move on. Yeah. So well done, Ford, and actually well done, Toyota, for keeping such
absolutely. An old vehicle. I mean, as I like pointing out constantly, that's verging on a 10-year-old ute, essentially.
Yeah,
battling for number one with a absolutely cutting edge modern.
Done extremely well. So. Just a further sort of quite interesting thing, I think. If you lumped passenger cars and utes together, the top five selling vehicles in New Zealand for the year would have been Toyota Corolla first, Ford Ranger second. So that's Ranger second out of everything on the market. Toyota Hilux would have been third, Holden Commodore fourth. So, you know, we're always talking about the death of large cars, but Commodore is still hanging in there, and probably deservedly so. Great car. And a bit of a surprise, number five would have been Holden Colorado, which is not one you'd expect to see in there.
Not at all. Oh, that is very interesting.
The other quite well-publicised battle that goes on in new cars is for the number one luxury brand, and the people in this segment are actually even more childish than the people in the ute segment. But just for the record, BMW stayed number one in New Zealand. They sold 2,126 cars, followed by Audi with 2,075. So skin of your teeth, BMW, but feel free to brag. Mercedes actually catching up fast with 1,811, and Mercedes have actually publicly said that they want to be number one this year because they've got a whole bunch of new cars. They've got crossovers and things coming, which are
and
really
they've actually caught up by quite a large margin.
They have. They're just racing.
They were quite
ahead.
A distant third previously. Yeah.
And it's not all down to crossovers. They've had some fantastic new cars, haven't they? A-Class and the new C-Class is awesome. Yeah. So, yeah, good stuff.
All right, well, Car and Driver in the States has recently revealed some photos of what they say is the mid-engined Chevrolet Corvette.
I like this.
We all do. And in fact, rumours of a mid-engine Chevrolet Corvette have been around for as long as the Corvette, basically. But this time, the photographs would appear to be quite compelling. Not simply because it shows a Corvette, but more that it actually shows a Commodore SSV Ute. You're looking at me like I'm strange.
And I'm looking at your computer trying to see a picture of it. I can't see one.
No, because I haven't got a picture up of it at the moment. But I will be rest assured we shall put pictures up on the web on the Facebook page.
I'll look then.
You can look then, yes. But it's a heavily modified SS Ute with the tray covered in, the back all covered off, and it certainly does appear to have a mid-engined stance to it.
That's a fantastic idea because a Commodore Ute is useless of carrying things in, so you may as well put an engine in the back of it.
In fact, forget a mid-engined Corvette. Just do a mid-engined Commodore Ute. I mean, that would be
a good way
to go out.
Before it's too late.
Anyway, we'll put the link to the Car and Driver article up on the Facebook page as well as photos, and let us know what you think. It certainly is interesting.
Now, what have you been driving over Christmas?
Oh, I've been driving. I've had a selection of powerhouses over Christmas.
Go on.
In fact, I've had two three-cylinder cars. First is the BMW 218i Active Touring.
What an odd name. What's that?
An odd name. Well, it's an odd car, to be fair.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, a 2 Series is a small coupe.
That is what you would previously have thought, but BMW have sought to upset their very structured naming system by throwing a small 5-door people mover-esque hatch into the range now.
Makes perfect sense to me.
As you would. I mean, why not? Why not spend all that money branding a certain way and then just upset the apple cart by doing the exact opposite?
People may have seen these around now because they've sort of in showrooms now, and I've actually seen a few on the road. So what's it all about?
Well, the one I had was the 218i Active Tourer, which was the 1.5-litre three-cylinder petrol-engined one, which coincidentally is the same engine that happens to feature in the Mini. Equally coincidentally, the platform under it would appear to be the same as the 5-door Mini.
That's really convenient, isn't it?
It is handy, that. It's priced at $51,900, and it's actually a lovely little car.
But wait, I have a question. If it's based on a Mini platform, does this mean it's front-wheel drive?
That does mean it's front-wheel drive, flying in the face of everything that BMW has previously stood for.
Which is why it's been quite controversial, hasn't it?
It has. To me, though, I find the naming convention more annoying than the fact it's front-wheel drive. It's a very BMW-like little car to drive, especially around town. It's very comfortable. You've got the beautiful BMW interior. It works really, really well. The only time you would really notice that it's front-wheel drive is when you're out on a windy back road, really pushing it, which I doubt anyone who buys one of these things is going to do.
Because I guess the difference from the Mini is you're sitting a bit higher, aren't you? And
it's probably a bit softer as well. It's considerably softer than a Mini. You are sitting up higher. It's an odd feeling to be in what is clearly a BMW and feeling a slight hint of understeer as you're pushing into a corner. But, I mean, 99.99% of the people that buy it won't care.
Yeah, and it's quite a versatile little thing, isn't it?
It's a very... I did refer to it as BMW's Honda Jazz. Which, given how much I like the new Jazz, is a compliment these days.
Someone who's not in the car game, either in the industry or a journalist, drove one the other day, and I was talking to him, and he said it was the oddest thing to drive a BMW. It sort of felt a bit like a Holden Trax. I don't know if it was supposed to be unkind, but I did say to him, well, it's based on the Mini platform, and it's front-wheel drive, and he sort of face lit up, and he said, oh, that explains it. Yeah. So people do notice.
People do notice.
Saying.
Yes, that's true, but they don't necessarily care.
They do a diesel one as well.
They do a diesel one as well. Yes, that's a lot of
nice alliteration.
Yes,
yep.
I thought so. But no, and sort of summing up, it was a pleasant little car that I really enjoyed driving, and I did quite a few miles in it. It was comfortable, and it was very much a BMW, despite the fact that it's pretty much a Mini.
Well, they like to create new niches, don't they?
They do.
BMW.
And
they're not afraid to sort of go a little bit left of centre, which kind of brings me to my car.
Absolutely.
That I was enjoying over Christmas, the X6 M50D. That's a lot of words and letters as well. X6 will be fairly familiar to people. It's basically, this is going to sound ridiculous, even as I know it's going to sound stupid, even as I prepare to say it. It's a coupe version of the X5 off-roader. X5 being a rather large, up to 7-seat family wagon. X6 has been around for a while. This is the brand new model. So we had a new X5 last year, so this is the new X6 spun off that. It's also an opportunity probably to talk about M Performance, because it's the X6 M50D, there I managed to get all those words out again, is a member of the M Performance family, which is sort of a halfway house between normal BMWs and the full M cars.
Full-blown M cars, which is something they did do for the X5 and the X6 a while ago, even though they said they would never do SUVs as full-blown M cars, but they did.
Yeah, there is an X6 M.
Yes.
Interesting thing, X6M's a big petrol V8. The M50D, which is the one we're talking about today, very expensive vehicle, $187,000. It's got a 3-litre turbo diesel 6 with 3 turbochargers, and actually it's got 740 newton metres of torque, which is almost as much as the X6M.
Yes.
It's just slightly less, and I can assure you that's no coincidence.
No,
it's 10 newton metres less.
Absolutely.
Gets to 100 k's an hour in 5.2 seconds. So it is fast, fast, fast.
And huge!
It is huge. Not if you're sitting in the back of it.
No. I did hop in the back of it when you had it, and can say firsthand that headroom is somewhat lacking for someone 6 foot plus.
Yep. But then it was never supposed to be a car. It's really a car. It's really a sort of a large two-seater.
More or less.
They did see the error of their ways. The original X6 was actually a four-seater. They were trying to make the point, this is a coupe, so you only need four seats. People complained quite loudly, I think, about that. So the latest model is actually a five-seater. I think the last versions of the previous model were actually five-seaters as well. It is a phenomenally good car to drive. You don't have to like the way it looks, although the new one I think has been toned down quite a bit over the old.
It has. I actually find myself looking back at the old one, which I never liked the look of particularly, and preferring it. I think they've kind of toned down the bits that didn't need toning down on this one, and kind of left the bit that they perhaps should have toned down, which was the odd humpy shape.
Yeah. I don't know. A lot to do with the way our test car was presented, I suppose. It was a white one with lots of nice black detailing and things on it. I actually thought it looked quite good. Maybe I've just got used to that shape.
Tell me, did yours have the power bulge?
Power bulge? No, I don't think it did.
Was it? No, power dome.
Power dome.
Power dome. I love that.
Yeah. Which is what they added to the sort of some of the last versions. But it's got lots of trick stuff in it. They sort of make an effort to make it a bit more special than the X5, just to differentiate it a bit, because it is a bit more expensive. So you get less space, but you get more equipment. So you get a fancy, it's got a completely digital dashboard now, which the X5 doesn't have yet. And it's really comprehensively equipped, very fast, as I said. And it's got all sorts of mad sort of chassis electronics. It's got adaptive suspension. It's got what BMW calls dynamic performance control, which is essentially torque vectoring. It can sort of shift power to the outside.
That was always the big differentiation between the X5 and the X6 when they first introduced it too, wasn't it?
Yes.
The X5 was the big SUV, and the X6 had all the handling bits. And
yeah, they've since added that performance control technology to X5, but the X6 has still got a wider track, and it's still, you know, a bit more rigid, and still a better drive if you're at all interested in taking your massive SUV onto a racetrack, which apparently some people are. So, I mean, I did enjoy it, you know, as much for the novelty and outrageousness of it as for, you know, performance and comfort.
Well, I'm going to steer you away from your large, excessive, powerful, fast vehicles and go back to another of my three-cylinder vehicles that I had over Christmas, the second of which was the Peugeot 308.
Now, I'm interested to hear about this because I have not driven a 308.
No, well, I have. You see, I spent quite some time in France driving it around the countryside.
Yes, I know you did.
I just like to bring that up every
time. Between restaurants.
In between restaurants and museums and so on, yeah. But the 308 is basically, well, I mean, it's basically a Golf now. It looks very much like a Golf. They've made the looks a lot more conservative, gone towards more of a traditional hatchback, which is fine. It's a handsome little car.
Because the previous model was quite outrageous looking, wasn't it?
It was had the big sort of Peugeot massive badge, quite a big nose on it, and it was sort of again, it appealed to quite a lot of people, and it sort of horrified quite a lot of people too, I think. But this has gone very traditional. I won't say conservative, because I think it's actually quite a handsome little car. The one I drove was the Active, which is sort of your mid-spec. It retails for $34,990, and it comes with the thing that makes the Peugeot 308 particularly special, a 1.2-litre three-cylinder turbo petrol engine.
Which is a very small engine for a relatively large car.
It is a very small engine for a relatively large car, but it handles it absolutely brilliantly. It's got 96 kilowatts and 230 newton metres, so it's certainly not lacking in power and torque. Incredibly economical. They claim 5.2 litres per 100 k's, but I was currently sitting on much better than that the last time I looked.
So that's sort of diesel-like economy, isn't it?
Very much so. And you occasionally notice the size of the engine when you're driving it and you're going up a steep hill or something like that. It just kind of needs a bit more stirring along to keep it going. But other than that, it's just a fantastic little engine, and it sounds great.
Yeah, well, three-cylinder engines always do.
Absolutely.
I don't think it'll be too much of a culture shock for potential buyers, because a lot of the work with downsizing's already, marketing work I'm talking about, it's already been done by companies like Volkswagen. They've had relatively big cars with small engines for quite a while now. So people are sort of used to that idea, aren't they?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, Volkswagen made that big deal out of not badging their cars with capacity size, and they went for power output. Peugeot has not really done anything in that regards. They just
Peugeot just decided to leave the badge off.
Well, they even decided just to keep calling it a 308, whereas previous, I mean, you go with their previous numbering conventions, it should be a 309. But then they changed that a while ago, so it's a 308, and that's what it stays from now on. But no, it really is a lovely little car. The interior is well up there with Golf standards. Keep comparing it to the Golf, but that is the car that it's up against in that segment.
Does it everybody? Yeah.
Everybody is compared to a Golf in that segment, and it certainly does stand up to a Golf well. I guess the only question that will probably linger in buyers' minds is, it is still a French car.
It's a French car that's won the European Car of the Year, though, isn't it?
And it's plastered all over the back of the window. Every time you look in the mirror, you're reminded of that fact.
As you would.
If it had been eligible for the Car of the Year this year, it would be in New Zealand. It would have been interesting to see which way it
would have gone. It will be this year.
It will be.
There's still time.
There is time.
Because it's
time.
Taken a while to get here.
It has. It's been out in Europe for over a year now.
Yeah, as seems to be the case with Peugeot, they seem to have a real struggle sort of getting right-hand drive cars.
Yeah. The other good thing, possibly the best thing about this car too, is it doesn't have a traditional French automatic transmission, which is generally a four-speeder that can't make up its mind. This has got a very, very modern six-speed dual-clutch transmission that is just absolutely brilliantly matched to the engine, and it works really, really well.
Now, do you have to have the Comedy engine, or have they got bigger
engines? No, they have bigger engines. They've got a 1.6-litre petrol as well, which has got a more normal cylinder count of 4.
Yeah, and they must have a diesel as well.
Yes, they do. Yep. That's here shortly, but I love the little 1.2. I think it's an absolutely fantastic engine, and if you can get it past your, out of your mind that you're driving a very, very small engine in a fairly sort of sizable car, it feels fantastic.
Well, while I was enjoying the X6 for the majority of my break, I did spend a few days away from Auckland, where I live, and I drove a couple of older Mercedes-Benzes, which I found quite interesting, and I'm probably going to sound really spoilt because we're very lucky we get to drive the very latest cars. It's our job to test the latest cars and the latest technology. But these were both 2007 model Mercedes-Benzes, which, I guess is not that old in the scheme of things. But they were really high mileage cars. Both belonged to family members. We were just using them to trip about, but I did a few miles in each of them. One was a GL320 CDI, so that's the big seven-seat job.
Yep.
And the other one was the R320 CDI, which is actually quite a rare car.
It is quite a rare car. Yeah. It didn't sell in massive numbers anywhere.
No, they didn't. So that's the, I don't know how to describe it. It's sort of like a cross between a people mover and an off-roader.
Yeah.
Tell you what, we'll stick a picture of one up on the website. That's the easiest way to deal with it, isn't it?
Absolutely. But wasn't it based on some?
It's based on the
Chrysler platform.
Well, it's based on the ML/GL platform, but that was shared with some Chryslers as well. Yeah. I think the Chrysler Pacifica.
Yeah.
So it's all part of the family. They're both built in the United States.
And I believe the R-Class is possibly the only car in history that Mercedes has come out and admitted that it was a mistake to build this.
Yeah, it was a bit of a flop. Quite an intriguing car.
It was.
An unusual car. It's only six. The earlier versions of which this is one, they're only six seats. Again, another company making this mistake, trying to make a point by not putting as many seats in as they could. Later versions came along with 7 seats because everyone said, "Why, we've got this massive car with only 6 seats." But anyway, the GL had done 180,000 Ks. The R-Class had done 270,000 Ks. And the reason why I thought it'd be interesting just to talk about them for a moment is that they both felt incredibly good. Certainly not like brand new cars, but man, they were still chugging along really well, good to drive, and I think it's just a tribute to the robustness and durability of Mercedes-Benz vehicles, even ones built in America.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, they're both just cars that are used on a regular basis. They're not, you know, not particularly coveted, I don't think. They're just family transport. In fact, one of them, the service indicator was showing it was 26,000 kilometres overdue for its service, so... So, you know, an interesting experience. And it was just a lesson for me in how fast the car industry moves too. Because, okay, not old cars, 2007, but so much stuff missing out of them that you expect these days. Yes. There was nowhere to plug in my iPod. I looked and looked. There was nowhere to plug in my iPod.
That's a potential day ruiner right there.
It is, yeah. It did ruin my day. Yeah. Which is, you know, it's funny because you think, you know, nowadays, even the cheapest $20,000 hatchback, you can plug your iPod in and get full sort of, you know, control of your music. No Bluetooth. I was trying to Bluetooth my phone. No Bluetooth.
Another thing that you expect even on a relatively cheap car.
Yeah,
these days,
so they have, that was back in the time when Mercedes-Benz had built-in phones, but you had to have your own special phone for car, or I think you could put a SIM card in as well. So, but, you know, they had other things like sat-nav and what have you. So, yeah, interesting cars. I really enjoyed driving them. Both just a sort of a bit of a blast from the past because I remember when both of those cars were launched and driving them and the promises and lies that were told about both of them at the time. But yeah, a neat way to tool around on my holiday.
Well, it's interesting too because we often, I mean, we get cars when they're brand new.
We do.
Obviously enough. And you come across a number of people who sort of say, oh, well, you know, like, the Toyota Hilux, for example, great vehicle. It goes for, I've got one that's 100,000 Ks on. It's like, well, you know, we can't test for that.
No, that's
an
unknown quantity.
We can't hold them on for 20 years and run them for 20 years. And it's interesting to actually get the chance to drive cars that you were familiar with when they were brand new.
Yeah, and I'm conscious of the fact that we're both sounding really spoiled.
I know.
Because the reality is that cars that companies put on as press test vehicles for the likes of us, they only do, I think, maybe 10,000 kilometres before they get turned over.
I think that's a general rule of thumb here, most
Yeah, so, yeah, it's another side of motoring, and in reality, it's the side that most people are experiencing.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's a shame that we can't do 100,000 Ks in cars to really test them.
I think so, yeah.
The opportunity's but open there.
Then we'd get quite bored with the car by that time, I think. But anyway.
Shall we talk about the far future?
I think we should. It's certainly the interesting thing of the moment, isn't it, with the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a car show, though.
It doesn't, and it's not, generally speaking, but it is fast becoming one, it seems.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So the CES is sort of the big... It's an American show, but I guess it's really global, isn't it? It gets global media coverage.
There's certainly companies from all over the world. It's their big...
Very exciting.
Where they reveal all their big coming excitement for the year and well beyond that. So
I guess it's the place to go if you want to find out about the future of televisions and mobile phones and
anything,
any kind
really.
Of consumer electronic.
Well,
in
indeed,
fact.
Consumer,
But the interesting thing about this year's CES is there have been a record number of car brands attending and showing off their latest wares. And that's interesting in itself because the Detroit Motor Show follows right on the back of CES, and car companies don't have unlimited amounts of money to spend on these shows, and it's a very expensive exercise to actually you know, hold a display at one of these things. So it's significant that so many of them have chosen to spend the big bucks and go there. Out of the 10 brands, you know, the big ones, Audi, Mercedes-Benz, Ford, General Motors, Toyota, they're all there. And a number of interesting announcements and new cars and new technology actually on show.
Yeah, indeed. And it goes to show, I think, the growing attention that car makers are giving towards, well, for lack of a better word, I hate using this word, but connectivity.
Whoa, yes.
And how people... Pretty much, I mean, it was like us talking about the older cars not having Bluetooth and a place to plug in your iPod. This is going further than that, and that people expect to be connected and online all the time.
A lot of car companies see it as the secret to success in the future.
Absolutely.
Because new generations of people coming up aren't necessarily car enthusiasts, whereas once upon a time they were. Yep. They'll only get into cars if they have this kind of connectivity and, you know, latest high-tech features. So Toyota made a big announcement. I think we've talked on a previous podcast, on the New Zealand Tech podcast it was, actually,
it
now
was,
I'm thinking back.
Right.
It wasn't
yes, it
on
was.
New Zealand Motoring. We talked a little bit about the Toyota fuel cell vehicle, which is called the Mirai, which is Japanese for future. That's been launched now, so it's a hydrogen car. So that's not news, but what's news is that at CES, Toyota announced that they were offering a number of patents that they'd registered for this car free of charge to any other car companies that want to use them. So basically what they're saying is, if you want to build a hydrogen car like ours, feel free, we'll show you our homework and you can copy it.
It's an interesting move. And the car market is, I guess it's evolving into one that would perhaps take advantage of that, but traditionally they've always kind of probably resisted.
Well,
because they didn't invent it, they won't use that. Unless they steal it off someone else, of course. Then they'd use it.
They do plenty of that. I mean, the downside is someone can come along, take that you know, work that... Mm. I mean, Toyota's poured about 20 years into this thing, so it's their next big project. The downside is someone could come along, take that technology and build a better car. But the upside is that I think Toyota realised that they need this car to succeed, and the only way it's going to succeed is if lots of other car makers are making hydrogen cars as well.
That
because
is true.
That's going to help spur the infrastructure.
Absolutely.
That's going to make hydrogen fuel more mainstream, and they can't do it alone. So, yeah, it's a risky but interesting move, I think. I'm just reading the number, 5,680 patents that have been registered for this car are now available
to
anybody who wants them. So if you've got a burning desire to build yourself a hydrogen fuel cell car, and all that you've been lacking is that last 94% of technology that you need to complete the project, now's your chance.
Now's your chance. If you've got a spare several billion lying around, go for it.
Of course, a bit of a side issue, but Tesla did a similar thing, didn't they?
With
their electric technology last year.
Yes, the electric technology. They were open to
taking it up. They basically open-sourced it and said, anybody who wants it, they are welcome to it. So, yeah, maybe this is the way of the future.
Caring and sharing.
Yeah, instead of car companies competing and copying each other, they're all going to hold hands and work together for a brighter future. A few other interesting things at CES. Volkswagen showed a concept version of the Golf R with a touch dashboard and hand gesture technology. I don't know if that's the technical term for it. But it basically is showcasing a new type of dashboard and sort of infotainment system. Not a million miles away from what Volkswagen Group already has in cars, like TT's got a digital dash, isn't it?
Yeah,
and some versions of the Passat, I think, in the United States at least, and maybe Europe too, have similar technology. But it's all virtual, and it's sort of got an expanded version of the infotainment system that you get in production models now, which is capable of doing a number of different things depending on what you want of it.
And it even senses when your hand's getting close and brings the button up larger on the screen for you to touch, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
so the production cars do that now. So this is sort of an extension of that. And it's fitted with something which is actually going to become quite common in the years to come. It's got a 3D camera fitted in the roof of the car, and it monitors the driver and passenger, and it can read your hand gestures. So if you want to, for example, open the sunroof, you would wave your hand across the sunroof, and it would either do that for you or bring up a control on the touchscreen that would allow you to do that. So that's
while
the direction.
Three pedestrians on the side of the road are confused as to why you're waving at them.
So you can see the potential, and it's not dissimilar from, I suppose, gaming technology, is it?
No,
you know,
not at
Xbox
all.
Connect and what have you. I mean, it's quite viable technology.
So there is a chance that in the near future, if someone cuts you off and you're gesturing angrily at them, you could turn the stereo up, open your windows, and
change the
light all at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go.
So BMW, obviously a company very keen on new technology, they showcased a remote valet parking system. I'm making sure I get the technology right, the terminology right. It's remote parking valet, sorry. So what this car can do is it's connected to a smartwatch, and you roll up where you want to be, you get out of your car, and you punch a couple of buttons on your watch, and the car will go off and park itself in a parking building.
It's the dream, isn't it?
It's the dream. Well, it does work. Now, the interesting thing about this is that it works in multi-level car parking buildings because it doesn't just rely on GPS and the mapping in the car. It also has grid maps of parking structures in it. So the car can basically drive itself without any assistance from global positioning satellite, mm-hmm. which is really the new aspect of this technology. It's really just a little bit of sugar to make the medicine go down, because what it's actually showcasing also is BMW's anti-collision technology. So it uses 360-degree cameras as well, and that's why it can be sort of off the grid in terms of GPS and still avoid obstacles and deal with situations as they arise. If you've got a car pulling out in front of you, it can, you know, detect that, obviously, and avoid it. So quite a clever thing. It does work, apparently. I've read a number of stories from media who have been there, have seen the thing demonstrated, and it does work. They've fitted it to an i3. So that makes it even more creepy, because you've got a completely silent electric car skulking around a high-rise car parking building with no driver looking for a parking space.
And I imagine the likes of the car parking companies are absolutely dying for this technology, because it'll mean they'll be able to put the car park spaces even closer together.
Well, that is the dream, isn't it? Yeah. Squeeze another 10 or 20 parking spaces on a floor, because I suppose that's the reality, isn't it? It's very clever, but it's not going to liberate any more parking spaces.
No.
So there's going to be all these driverless cars wandering around looking for parking spaces.
So all the fuel they're saving with all this new, you know, electric hybrid technology will be wasting again with them wandering around for hours on end because they can't find
that's
a parking
spot. I wonder if it can plug itself in when it gets there. Well, of course it can, because BMW have developed wireless charging technology, but we'll talk about that another day.
And another thing that just came up recently was Tesla are intent on developing their robotic snake that pops out of the wall. And
that's not the image that came to mind.
No, it's not. And I mean, it just goes again to reaffirm my belief that Elon Musk is a Bond villain developing robot
snakes.
Let's
not go there again. So Audi, now we've talked a little bit about Audi's driverless cars. In our first podcast, we talked about an RS7 that went around a racetrack all by itself. Well, for CES, Audi sent a car, an A7, not an RS7, an A7, with similar technology, which is called Jack for some reason. I don't know why, that's just what they've called it. They sent it 340 kilometres from Palo Alto to Las Vegas to the show. It sort of drove itself. It was part of a media event, so journalists were sort of able to drive it 160 k's or so at a time. The self-driving technology was showcased. However, it wasn't able to go all the way by itself. Audi very openly admits that the self-drive technology still can't handle dense traffic or really unexpected situations. And in fact, if the car encounters something that it doesn't think it can deal with, it will tell the driver to take over. And if the driver doesn't take over, the car will park itself.
So, I would suggest that there's a flaw in that plan. They say if it gets too dense and too much for the car, it will go and park itself. That's asking a lot of it to make its way through the dense situation to park itself. If it can handle that, surely it can carry on.
Maybe it just stops in the middle of the road.
Maybe it does. It just the automotive equivalent of throwing your hands up in the air and just stopping where you are.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought it was remarkably honest of Audi, A, to showcase that, and B, to sort of admit that actually, you know, the technology's not quite there yet. You know, it can do certain things, can't do others.
Well, we are getting to that point a wee bit, and that at the CES, Ford also made a very intriguing announcement where they basically, new boss Mark Fields got up on stage and said, we're not making autonomous cars until we think the technology's there. Which is either Ford's way of saying we haven't got the technology,
or we're going to wait for someone else.
We're going to wait for someone else, hopefully to make it freely available to us, as right. Toyota are doing.
We're going to wait for Toyota to make a self-driving car, and then we're going to ask if we can have it. Oh, well, honesty's
but,
good.
Well, it's interesting in that as far as we have come, we have got a lot of cars that are virtually capable of driving themselves, actually driving around on the roads today. There's still a long way to go before we are confident in letting them do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's all sorts of legislative issues around that.
So it's going to take a while yet. But
And in fact, the Audi A7 drive route went through a couple of states. And, of course, some states allow self-driving cars to be tested, some don't. And apparently they had to, at least once, pull over and change license plates, because autonomous cars, by law, have to have a special license plate. So, yeah, there's all sorts of legislative things that are a nuisance. But, I mean, self-driving cars were very much a thing at CES. That's kind of the technology everyone's talking about.
Absolutely.
And the really big one, and the one that's probably had the most publicity, was the Mercedes-Benz F015. I don't know why Mercedes-Benz have this weird naming structure. They've been calling their concept, they're sort of truly new concept cars. They've always had an F designation and have done as long as I can remember. Yeah. And the other thing that's united them all is they've all been hideous. I guess because they're trying to differentiate them from their rather elegant yes. production cars.
Yes, yes.
But anyway, we've got a man on the spot, haven't we?
We do. Our valiant producer and host of the New Zealand Tech podcast, Paul Spain, is actually over at CES, and he has a chat with someone from Mercedes, which we will play for you right now.
Okay, so right now we're looking at the new concept vehicle from Mercedes-Benz, and right now I'm with...
I'm Paolo Malabuio, and I lead the advanced user experience design team for Mercedes-Benz based out of the Silicon Valley.
Great, well thank you very much for joining me. Now, this is a pretty exciting day for you, I guess, showing off this new vehicle that quite a lot of time, I no doubt, has gone into in terms of research and development before the unveiling to the public here at CES.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that was mentioned yesterday was we've been working on autonomous driving technology for about 30 years, but this particular project actually got into full swing about 2 years ago. So there are a lot of people here are quite happy to actually see it come on the stage and actually perform the way it was meant to.
Well, that's pretty fast moving for the automotive industry, isn't it? Well, you know, where it takes years and years often for vehicles certainly to get to market. But even for a concept vehicle like this, it seems like a fairly short time period.
I think if you think about from a concept vehicle, it's probably, don't quote me on this, but, you know, a fair amount of time. But in this case, we probably haven't ever delivered a concept vehicle or research vehicle of this complexity, right? It is a fully functioning research vehicle that is a completely new design language from the inside and out, as well as introducing a new way to actually have this space that goes along with you, and it's supposed to be self-driving. That's a lot to pack into 2 years. It's impossible to deliver that production ready, but it's definitely ready to drive around, and it drove around on the strip last night.
Looking at the technology that's there, and I mean, visually, this is stunning. It's an incredible vehicle, and we do expect that from concept vehicles. But what's different here, as well as that, are all of the technological elements. Some of those built in visually, and we've got some of those external cues and communications that come into play with pedestrians that are maybe wondering whether they can walk in front of the vehicle or not, and so on. Maybe you can just talk us through what are really the highlights technologically, and tell us what's unique in terms of those self-drive type capabilities from what we've seen and heard about in the past.
Sure. I think the autonomous driving things we've actually done to a decent degree over the past couple of years, right? We did this Mercedes-Benz drive a couple of years ago, so you can imagine that we're continuing to work on that. So I'll probably highlight things that aren't really directly related to autonomous driving, because there are a whole bunch of opportunities that it opens up when you no longer need to drive. So let's start with from the outside, like you mentioned. We've got these big LED grille on the front and the back, and it's not just for lights. We use it to communicate to people on the outside. You know, it's a great opportunity for us to design for trust. You and I as humans, you know, if we're driving around, or if you're driving and I'm a pedestrian, I only feel safe when I can make eye contact with you that you're not going to hit me when I'm trying to cross the road. When there's no one to make eye contact with, okay, so those are opportunities for us to design, and we thought that the grill is one great way to do it, right? It's clear to see, and so we've created some languages to say we're in autonomous driving, as well as, yes, I see you, and then there's audio cues, and then at night we can also, using laser projector, to actually draw a crosswalk for you. A lot of really good hints to keep you safe, and you know that the car can see you.
So tell me a little bit about that. I mean, you're talking about visual cues and audio cues. What would that actually mean? For me as a pedestrian, right now I'm standing right in front of the vehicle. There is no cue that it's moving or doing anything. But if we were on the street, I would probably want to know. So what sort of cues could the vehicle give me to give me some confidence that I can walk in front of it or otherwise?
Sure. I mean, right now you're pretty much just seeing it sitting in the middle of the floor. So if all the systems are actually up and running for that, you might actually see these waves that look like it's emanating from the car, and it actually will, based on the shape, you can see very clearly, oh, it senses that I'm here. If you're directly in front of it, for example, and you start, you know, whether you're in the corner and you start walking, you'll see this blue light on the grill actually start to follow your movement. So you can see it's responding to you very directly. And then obviously when the laser light goes from, oh, I sense you, to crosswalk, it's a very clear indication that now you can walk, and then it says, please go ahead.
Right, so it's actually talking to you at that stage.
Correct. Exactly. And I mean, we don't only use one mode of communication as people, so there's no reason why we need to keep ourselves to a single mode of communication as a car.
Right. Now, I'm interested in the sort of technology that's inside the vehicle. Firstly, this is a premium vehicle. We expect it to have a bit of power. We're talking about an electric vehicle here. This is hydrogen powered. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So this is a fully electric vehicle. Right now it has two electric engines, 136 horsepower each. It's rear-wheel drive. It's not all-wheel drive. And the concept is electric and fuel cell, like you said, for a tremendous range. I think about 1,100 kilometers fully with a fully functioning hydrogen system. So it is autonomous, it's self-driving, and it's fully electric. So it's really that vision of the future. And by not requiring a combustion engine, it opens up the architecture completely, right? Like you kind of alluded to the shape. It doesn't look like a car that you can find today, right? So we've designed it around the ability of changing that relationship we have. When it goes in fully autonomous, the front seats can rotate, can pivot. So now you have four seats facing each other. So we've created this lounge. And to wrap that lounge inside this beautiful, beautiful shell that really exudes luxury, because that's who we are. Like, we're the company that really tries to deliver modern luxury. And you end up with the shape, and because it's electric, you have the opportunity to move things around to that degree.
Right, so looking inside, we step inside the vehicle and sit down. Pretty comfortable experience. As you say, the seats can swivel around, so if there were a group of three or four people in there, we can be facing each other. What are the other pieces of technology that we're going to see sitting inside the vehicle? What sort of screens and so on exist?
So if you're in the front two seats, and let's say you're facing forward, you're looking at a fully digital dashboard. And the dashboard has multiple cameras and sensors so that we can do gaze detection and facial detection. So we actually can tell what control on the dashboard you're looking at. So that's how you can target. And then you can use gesture to actually be able to control whatever it is, right? Change my temperature, actually speed up, or et cetera. So that's one of the really cool things you got. You're not pressing any buttons or anything. When you are, whether you're in the back seat or you're in the front seats and you're playing with the side screens, so each door has one large touchscreen. And we built systems where everyone has a screen that they can play with themselves, and we've got delivered a whole bunch of different ideas where you can either explore the world around you, points of interest as you're driving by, or you can actually simulate or feel like you're somewhere else. It's almost like you're wrapped in this 360-degree display where, okay, now I may be in my regular commute, but I want to look like I'm driving through like a beautiful landscape.
Now, in terms of looking back at the autonomous driving capabilities, because obviously you're not going to be swiveling your chair around and facing in the other direction unless you can really trust those, how important are new changes in terms of vehicle-to-vehicle communications, infrastructure that can communicate to the vehicle, and so on? Some of those new things that maybe don't generally exist today. Do you think those are a necessity for self-drive vehicles, or are those just things that are going to bump up the safety factors?
I think it's probably more the latter. They completely bump it up. I think we're still experimenting with whether or not we can create completely self-sufficient ones. So I think the vision is you want something that is fully dependable, right? So in the case of even if you end up losing connectivity, you have that problem today with your cell phone, right? You still, in terms of a car, you still want it to work. Right, so obviously, we need to, once we actually deliver something in the market, we want to make sure that safety is never compromised. And we're always pushing connectivity. We want to make sure that car-to-car, car-to-X, and all that is actually working. And we know that once you have full connectivity, everything just gets better.
Now, the fact that this is a fully working vehicle sort of says that, a large degree of what we're seeing here now, is complete. This could be on the market within a reasonably short sort of space of time if you decided to go down that track, if it was going to be practical from, financial perspective, et cetera. But looking at it from a realistic perspective, the sort of the key elements here, when do we expect those sort of new innovations to arrive in the market? What's your personal pick?
Honestly, one, we've talked about this concept as something that we think can actually come to fruition around 2030-ish, right? So we're talking about 15 years in the future. However, it's hard to say which ones are going to be here in the next couple of years versus which ones are further out. Because, if you take a look at autonomous driving, we've got semi-autonomous features still that you can actually get in cars today, right? We don't have to say in the future. You can have that now. So you can probably see it's not going to be this black and white transition. You're going to have this gradual integration of these new technologies where you'll start to see these roll out more and more. Just like all our research vehicles, they're platforms for us to explore as well as see, okay, there are technologies and design cues that we can use to inspire production vehicles. I don't think we'd say you're going to see a car that looks exactly like this and functions exactly like this on the market. However, you're going to start to see cars that maybe in a few years you'll go, oh, I remember when they talked about that. I remember when they introduced that. So you can see that red thread connecting the experiences that we are talking about today as a concept versus the cars that we're going to deliver in the future.
Now, this has come out of your research and development center in the Silicon Valley. This seems to be a trend that's been developing within the automotive industry. Mercedes-Benz, Daimler, you're based in Germany, but really the R&D has been done here in the US. Tell us a little bit about that story and why that's happening.
To clarify that a little bit, it really is a worldwide effort. We do have an R&D center in Silicon Valley, and you've got designers and engineers working very closely on the digital experiences. However, you can say the mechanical and the autonomous driving stuff. Okay, those engineering teams are mostly in Germany. The exterior design team that worked on this was in Germany. The interior design team that worked on this is in Italy. So it is a global effort, right? We've got a global R&D, presence, and this is a great example of all of those people doing what they do best, working together on it. So as much as I'd love to say those of us in Silicon Valley made this happen, there's no way that we could deliver something like this without everyone actually pulling their weight.
But how important is it for you to be there in the Valley, which is known as a place for startups and for innovations, but as an established firm, the most established firm, I guess, in the automotive industry, to be there amongst those startups and with the minds that exist, such as yours in the era?
Sure. That goes back to the idea of what are the things that we can do best. And Silicon Valley, you're right. We're known for that kind of breakthrough innovations that have changed each of our lives, and one of the reasons why we're talking today. Software, digital experiences, that's our core competency. And a lot of those that you see in this car today came from those teams. Exterior design, interior design, we've got competency centers. They do that. So we focus on high-tech, digital experiences, software, and the integration of all that together. We've got an autonomous driving team that's also in Silicon Valley. But it takes a lot of people to make this stuff happen. So we're not trying to do everything in Silicon Valley. We're trying to focus on our strengths.
That's great. Well, thank you very much for your time, Paulo.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
That was Paul Spain from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas.
I could hear the hustling and bustling as he spoke.
Indeed, there's lots of hustling and bustling in Las Vegas. Anyway, that is all for this episode. Thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you. And enjoy your 2015.
Indeed. Have a good one.
We'll see you soon.
See you shortly.
The New Zealand Motoring Podcast, brought to you by podcasts.co.nz.